Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Reports from eastern Ukraine of a gun battle, 4 killed, and the death toll from the sunken South Korean ferry. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington. Reports from eastern Ukraine say gunmen have attacked a checkpoint manned by pro-Russian separatists, killing at least 4 people. The early morning attack near the town of Slavansk could not be immediately confirmed by Ukraine's interior ministry, as the town is under control of pro-Russian militants. The attack comes just hours after the Ukrainian government announced a pause in security operations to oust pro-Russian militants from buildings they seized in recent days. South Korean divers have entered the sunken ferry to recover more bodies as the death toll reached 56 this day, with 246 still unaccounted for. Most of the victims are high school students. Hundreds of divers, including civilian volunteers, battled strong undercurrents, poor visibility, and cold to enter the submerged ferry, which went down Wednesday with 476 people on board. There are only 174 known survivors, with no one rescued since Wednesday. VOA's Daniel Scharf reports from Jindo.
After 4 days of failed attempts, South Korean divers have finally entered the sunken ferry. But after so long, maritime police and emergency workers at Pangmok Harbor bring back only bodies of the dead. Anguished relatives of the victims, most of them students on a school trip, identify the bodies.
This is not my Korea. This is my child.
A church service held Sunday in Ansan, where most of the victims came from, remembers those lost. Pastor Go Hoon describes how one student, trapped on the ship, appears to have tried to escape.
The child of our deacon returned yesterday from Jindo as a dead body, trapped inside and trying to escape.
As police boats head back to the sunken ferry, few expect anyone to be rescued in what is quickly becoming South Korea's worst maritime disaster in decades. Daniel Scherf, VOA News, Jindo, South Korea.
Syria has removed or destroyed 80% of its declared chemical weapons material. Sigrid Kaag, a special coordinator for the joint mission of the United Nations and the Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, said if momentum is sustained, Syria should be able to meet the deadline set by the OPCW for the destruction of the weapons before the end of April. Kaag said the renewed pace in movements is positive and necessary to ensure progress with the tight deadline. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad agreed to destroy Syria's stockpile of chemical weaponry after mounting international criticism following the deaths of hundreds of people in a sarin gas attack on the outskirts of Damascus last year. Washington and its Western allies blame Mr. Assad's forces for unleashing the nerve agent. The Syrian government blamed rebels in Syria's civil war, which is now in its fourth year. Egyptian gunmen say Egyptian officials say two gunmen killed members of the country's security forces. The Interior Ministry says the gunmen opened fire today when security forces attempted to stop the vehicle that the attackers were in on a road outside of Cairo. Israeli police arrested 16 Palestinians for throwing rocks near the Al-Aqsa Mosque on Jerusalem's holy site. Officials say two police were wounded in the fighting with the demonstrators. The area is one of the most sensitive religion sites in the region and the center of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Jews call it Temple Mount, as it is the location of two of their biblical temples and is the holiest place in Judaism. It is Islam's third holiest site and known among Muslims as the Noble Sanctuary. Christians around the world are celebrating Easter this weekend, marking the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. Robert Berger attended the services in Jerusalem, the city where, according to the Bible, the events took place.
Jesus conquered the grave.
Easter dawned in Jerusalem with a sunrise service at the Garden Tomb. The faithful sang hymns and proclaimed that Jesus is risen. Pilgrims came from all over the world, including Jay Raxon from the U.S. state of Iowa.
Well, there's nothing really quite like it to celebrate Easter Sunday morning at the Garden Tomb.
A few hours later, Easter Mass was celebrated at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Priests and monks in festive robes chanted the Easter liturgy as a fragrant cloud of incense rose above the ancient stone tomb, which Christians believe is the very place where Jesus rose from the dead. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
And I'm Marty Johnson, VOA News, Washington. More news at voanews.com.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Happy Easter and thanks for joining us tonight. I'm Douglas Impoga.
Well, there's nothing really quite like it to celebrate Easter Sunday morning at the Garden Tomb. The tomb is empty. He's no longer in the grave. He's risen from the dead and he lives forever.
It's Easter and Christians around the world are celebrating the holiest day in the Christian faith.
So we are an immigrant-rich city and immigrants are in our schools. They are driving our economy. They're, you know, working hard at all levels and in all professions. And we need to support that because it not only benefits the families that are involved, but it benefits the city as a whole.
We take a look at how immigrants help New York City thrive. And in Egypt, an Egyptian gunman killed two members of the country's security forces. Those stories and more coming up right here on Nightline Africa. Christians around the world are celebrating Easter, marking the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. Robert Burger attended services in Jerusalem, the city where, according to the Bible, the events took place.
Heroes and conquered the grave. Jesus conquered the grave.
Easter dawned in Jerusalem with a sunrise service at the Garden Tomb. The holy place is said to resemble biblical accounts of the place where Jesus was buried. Facing an ancient, empty tomb carved into a rock, the faithful sang hymns and proclaimed that Jesus is risen. Pilgrims came from all over the world, including Jay Raxon from the U.S. state of Iowa.
Well, there's nothing really quite like it to celebrate Easter Sunday morning at the Garden Tomb. The tomb is empty. He's no longer in the grave. He's risen from the dead, and he lives forever.
A few hours later, Easter Mass was celebrated at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Priests and monks in festive robes chanted the Easter liturgy as a fragrant cloud of incense rose above the ancient stone tomb, which Christians believe is the very place where Jesus rose from the dead. It was a big turnout because the calendars of the Eastern Orthodox and Western churches coincide this year, and they are celebrating Easter on the same day. Andreou Gimas, an Orthodox pilgrim from Greece, said he was touched by the Holy Spirit.
The Holy Spirit is here and here and here. It's everywhere in this place because all the religions are here, and you can see the Holy Spirit.
But while the Easter observances were peaceful, there was trouble nearby at a Jerusalem holy place that is revered by both Muslims and Jews. Israeli riot police moved into the Mosque of Al-Aqsa compound and used stun grenades to disperse Palestinians throwing stones and firecrackers. The site is a flashpoint of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. For Jews, it is their holiest place, known as the Temple Mount, while the mosque marks the third holiest place in Islam. There have been clashes at the site over the past week during the Jewish Passover holiday amid a crisis in Israeli-Palestinian peace talks. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Fourteen Algerian soldiers are dead after an attack late Saturday by suspected Islamist militants. Algeria's state news agency says the soldiers were ambushed in the mountainous Tizi Ouzi region while returning from security duties related to Thursday's presidential election. President Abdelaziz Bouteflika was elected to a fourth term in the poll despite poor health. Reuters news agency cites an unnamed security source as saying the attackers are from Al-Qaeda's North African branch. Turkey will resume the direct budgetary support to the Somali government after it was cut off last year. Turkish ambassador to Somalia, Kani Turin, who spoke exclusively at VOA Somali service, says his government decided to continue the funding and will soon release $25 million of budget support intended for the year 2014. Since 2011, Turkey has spent over $350 million in Somalia on various projects, including humanitarian and development. On the line to Mogadishu, VOA Somali service, Abdulaziz Osman spoke to the ambassador and first asked him what triggered Turkey's support for Somalia.
2011, there was the big problem here, particularly in South Central. However, before that, Turkey organized a Somalia conference in 2010, first Somalia conference. And we started to work with the transitional federal government. So when the summer 2011, when the famine happened, that Turkish prime minister, actually, he visited, as you know, that historical visit, 19th of August, in Ramadan. He visited Mogadishu with his family. So he wanted to brought Somalia to world attention. So the main actually trigger was this famine and those pictures. And then, of course, you know, Prime Minister visit.
Mr. Ambassador, critics say you have business interests in Somalia. How do you respond to that?
Aid is a temporary issue. Best aid is trade. You know, this, you cannot continue to giving, you know, this bread or food to people forever. You need to make them to produce something themselves and get their, you know, this income through their own activities. So this is part of our activity. You know, as I said, we started with humanitarian. And now we are working in development as well as humanitarian. Of course, we haven't finished humanitarian. We are still working on the humanitarian side. But also, we are investing in development. So that transport, like the Turkish Airlines, now the roads and education as well. You know, we build schools and we send nearly 2,000 students to Turkey. So we invited companies to invest in Somalia. When the investment comes in a certain momentum, so people will be very careful not to destroy the country again.
Western development partners say you don't coordinate or collaborate with them. What's your answer to that?
I think this is unfair if they think really this is very unfair. First of all, we work with the Western development partners and we always cooperate. However, they are all working in Nairobi. You know, we are here in downtown Mogadishu. We work in Mogadishu and we are working directly with the government and coordinate everything with the government. Also, we inform them what we are doing. But they are only organizing everything. You know, the majority of their meetings, you know, everything are in Nairobi. I cannot go to Nairobi for those meetings. If I go there, I cannot continue my work here. So I think the best way, they should come here and work with us, like in Somalia, rather than, you know, this working in Nairobi.
Mr. Ambassador, recently the government of Turkey stopped the direct budget support for the Somali government, but the foreign minister said it will restart. What was the decision to stop the direct budget support?
Actually, it was not right. You know, the news is wrong. We did not stop. You know, in the beginning, we decided a certain amount of money done as budget support Somalia government till the end of 2013. And, of course, you know, it was the budget issue, and when it finished, it finished. And for 2014, again, we decided to continue. So that is already, you know, I can tell that $25 million budget support will be decided by Turkish government to give to Somalia federal government for the year of 2014. So it will resume very soon.
So overall, how much does Turkey spend on Somalia?
So far, we have spent around $250 million, roughly.
That was Turkish Ambassador to Somalia, Kani Turin. He spoke with VOS Somali Services, Abdulaziz Osman. Kenya recently ordered all refugees in the country to return to the camps of Dadaab and Kikuma. The Somali refugees and human rights organizations say the order violates freedom of movement of refugees. The directive could affect thousands of refugees who live outside the camps for medical, education and work-related purposes. Vincent Macori spoke to Daud Awis of the Somali Service, who described the reaction of Somali refugees he spoke to.
Actually, some of the Somali refugees we talked to were very, very angry. Some of them were very expressing concern that this is going to affect innocent families living in Nairobi. There are thousands of Somali and refugees living in the urban areas like in Nairobi, in Mombasa, in other towns of Kenya, who are doing business, who are in education, who are in different sectors of lives in Nairobi. So they say that is a failure of Kenyan government to target those who are committing crimes in Kenya. And instead, they are now trying to make like a total punishment to all Somalis who are living in the urban areas. And they say that they will try to talk to the Kenyan government, to the Somali government, and to the international NGOs like the human rights organizations to make sure that Kenya does not go ahead with this direction, which is going to affect their lives.
Now, this is not the first time. The last time they make such a, they made an announcement like this one, did they in any way try to implement it?
I think when such an decision was made last year, there was some intervention from the Somali government, as from the United Nations High Commission for Refugees and other organizations trying to persuade the Kenyan government not to take such an action. But this time Kenya is saying that because of the increasing insecurity and actions taking place in many places, like the recent one which took place in near Mombasa, where a church was attacked. So now they are trying to make sure that this decision now goes ahead. And the minister, when he was issuing it, said that this is a decision that is going to be fair to everyone, a decision that's going to protect the Kenyans. So Kenya now is trying to make sure that it now implements this decision, but there are many things to do with this decision if it wants to go ahead, like the resources and all the enforcement. It seems that Kenya will need help if it wants to do such a case, no, because the refugees, some of them are registered and some of them are not registered. So
actually, the one of the biggest challenges is how do you separate, for example, Kenyan Somalis and Somalis from Somalia? Have they given some direction as to how they're going to do that so they avoid harassing innocent people too?
That is another challenge, because these Somalis are mixed. You cannot identify a Somali from Somalia, a Somali from Kenya. The only thing that they can use to differentiate them is the identity card. Sometimes it happens that the Kenyan government is claiming some Somali refugees are also having some Kenyan IDs. So it's going to be very difficult to identify the genuine ID card holders who are Kenyans of Somali ethnic, and the other ones who are from Somalia who may be obtaining these documents through and corruption or anything that is taking place in Kenya. So that's going to be another challenge. And the fear is that in the past, there were some operations targeting the Somalis or maybe the Somali nationals living in Kenya. And the target became also, and the issue also affected the Somali Kenyans. So the Kenyan government will have a daunting task to make sure that it can identify those who are the genuine refugees and those who are not.
What does the Somali government in Mogadishu want to do in relation to, in reaction to this particular directive?
There was a plan and adopted by the Somali government and the Kenyan government and the United Nations about how to repatriate the Somali refugees living in Kenya, especially those living in the urban areas, to make a smooth process that will allow them to go back to their country without harassment, without any problem. But this seems to be an emergency case, and so far the Somali government has not reacted. But recently we have been talking to the Somali ambassador to Kenya. He said this was a shocking news to them, and they will try to reach the Kenyan government to make sure that they explain how they're going to implement this new direction.
That was reporter David Aways of the VOA Somali Service. He was speaking about a new Kenyan directive that would make Somali refugees working and living in urban areas return to camps. He was speaking with VOA's Vincent Macquarie. Egyptian officials say gunmen have killed two members of the country's security forces. The Interior Ministry says the gunmen opened fire Sunday when the security forces attempted to stop the attacker's vehicle on a road outside Cairo. Authorities say the security forces were overpowered by the gunmen and were not able to apprehend the assailants. Terrorist attacks in Nairobi and other towns in Kenya have dealt the country's economy a big blow in the last few years, but officials say the country is on a path to recovery. Henry Toritich is Kenya's cabinet secretary for the National Treasury. He tells VOA's Vincent Macquarie things are looking up for East Africa's largest economy.
Our calculations indicate that we are likely to grow by about 5%. The 5.8 is a forecast for this year. Mm-hmm.
Now, for any finance secretary, I think it's always critical to save money. For years, Kenyans bemoan the loss of billions through misappropriation, corruption, bad tendering, where we give the highest bidder rather than the lowest bidder. What are you doing right now to make sure that you can eliminate those loopholes?
That we have a new law, public financial management law. Before, we've not had a law. The law spells out clearly how public money it will be used. So we are implementing this law. We have just issued regulations to ensure that all spending agencies follow the regulations as opposed to following previous, you know, circulars that were not adhered to. So at least now we have get a clear legal framework on that. We are also doing a law to improve the procurement of goods. We're going to introduce a new procurement law to ensure that there is efficiency in the utilization of resources, and that should help reduce a lot of, you know, spending. But we believe going forward with the clear legal framework, we should deal with this challenge once and for all.
The Kenyan diaspora is very keen on investing back home, but there's always complaints about challenges back there. They feel like things haven't been streamlined. We want a registration of businesses, perhaps transactions when it comes especially to land and registration and all. What are you doing to ensure that you make it easier for someone here to bring money back home?
It's true that there have been some, you know, constraints in those areas that you have mentioned. And we actually, over the last 2 years, we've slipped back based on World Bank indicators that they have just released, which attest to clearly what you have said. We've now worked on a very comprehensive plan to implement very specific reforms in the areas that have been identified that have been a challenge in doing business, particularly in the land registry. We are also introducing a new law, company law and insolvency law, which will revolutionize how the registration of business will be. This law is already before Parliament. As you know, the Companies Act that we are operating in is very archaic, from 1948. So we need to update our laws first governing business.
But Kenya has had a beating since 2008 because of insecurity. Al-Shabaab and other terrorist groups are not making it any easier. So how can you possibly attract investors?
You already have noticed the actions the government has done of late in terms of dealing with the refugee challenges and immigration issues. We have also given police the necessary capacities in terms of the mobility. We are working on their welfare, including also the housing and all that. I think the actions that we are putting to modernize our security operators are going to deal with these problems once and for all. And we do expect, together with the actions we are doing on improving the business climate, should make Kenya a very attractive area to invest.
That was Henry Torich, Kenya's cabinet secretary for the National Treasury. He was speaking with VOA's Vincent Macquarie. New York City has long been a magnet for immigrants looking for a better life, but a new independent research study shows that immigrants help the city thrive as well. VOA's Adam Phillips has more.
Immigrants like those at this New York rally are an increasingly potent economic force. According to the mayor's office, immigrants make up more than 40% of the city's population. Taken together, those 3 million people would constitute the third largest city in America, says Immigration Commissioner Nisha Agarwal.
So we are an immigrant-rich city, and immigrants are in our schools. They are driving our economy. They're, you know, working hard at all levels and in all professions. And we need to support that because it not only benefits the families that are involved, but it benefits the city as a whole.
An independent research report sponsored by the American Society, Council of the Americas, or ASCOA, contradicts a common perception that links immigrants with poverty and crime. The study examined rising immigration statistics and neighborhood police reports between 1990 and 2010. New York City's economy and quality of life improved greatly during that period, especially in declining neighborhoods. The report's author, Jacob Vigdor, found a link.
The immigrants go to these neighborhoods because they're the only places they can afford, and they stabilize those neighborhoods. They reduce the vacancy rates. They reduce the state of disrepair. And these are the things that kind of lead to crime dropping.
Immigrants who make the leap of faith to come to America are often less likely to commit crimes and more likely to work hard, says Harvard University social policy professor Robert Thompson.
So, I mean, why would you come to this country? Well, you want to work, you want to get ahead, you want to raise a family, you want to build essentially a community.
Immigrant entrepreneurship also helps drive the city's growth, and immigrants often perform the necessary jobs native-born Americans don't want, says ASCOA policy manager Kate Brick.
Like in the agricultural sector, the manufacturing sector, the service industry, it runs the gamut. And at the same time, though, I mean, immigrants coming to the United States are extremely diverse. In addition to people that are working in, you know, lower-paying jobs, you have some of the best minds in the world that come here that are working in the tech industry, in engineering, in science, in the medical field.
Even undocumented immigrants who work as street vendors and nannies, for example, help pay their way, says Jacob Vigdor.
You need to buy things. And when you buy things, you pay sales taxes. Sales taxes are pretty substantial in New York. You need to live someplace. Whether you own a place or rent a place, there are property taxes on that dwelling. And property taxes and sales taxes are major sources of revenue for any kind of municipal government.
The American Society, Council of the Americas, is using its study on immigrants and the New York economy to help other U.S. cities to welcome immigrants in ways that will benefit foreign-born and native-born alike. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
Hello, I'm Kim Lewis.
And I'm Yehiyas Wuhib.
Together we host the Voice of America's informative program, Africa News Tonight.
We present a thorough summary of the day's events, featuring interviews with newsmakers in Africa and the world.
Also, Sunny Young drops in live with sports, and we have features on science, health, and business.
Tune in Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC right here on The Voice of America. We'll be right back.
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. And still to come in the program, sports with Segun Adeyemi from the Nigerian commercial capital Lagos. We'll then enjoy some music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary and analysis by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Let's kick off with Nightline Africa Sports. And for that, let's go straight to Lagos, Nigeria, and join Segun on the dot at DMA. Good evening, Segun.
Good evening, Douglas, and good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, April 20th. The first leg playoff round of the 2014 CAF Confederation Cup, Africa's second-tier club football competition, is being played across the continent this weekend. 16 teams are engaged in the home and away playoff, from which 8 teams will advance to the competition's mini-league stage. The teams include the 8 that dropped from the CAF Champions League and the Confederation Cup second-round winners. Africa's most successful club, Al Ahly of Egypt, is among the teams involved in the playoff after losing in the second round of the Champions League to Libyan club Al Ahly Benghazi. The Egyptians are now considered as the Confederation Cup favorites and will bid to become the first Egyptian side to win the Confederation Cup. Meanwhile, in the match played on Saturday, Byzantine of Tunisia played goalless with home team Nkana FC of Zambia, securing a slight advantage ahead of the return leg next weekend. Staying with African football, the Confederation of African Football, CAF, has concluded an inspection tour of Ivory Coast, the second such inspection of the country's bidding to host the 2019 and 2021 Africa Cup of Nations. The visit was aimed at reviewing the facilities by a special committee set up to evaluate the candidates. According to CAF, the committee rounded off its trip to the West African states with a visit to the Presidential Palace, where its members were received by Ivorian President Alassane Ouattara. President Ouattara reaffirmed to the CAF delegation the commitment of the Ivorian government to the Africa Cup bid. The delegation visited the 4 cities selected for the tournament, namely Bouaké, Korogo, San Pedro, and Abidjan. Yamoussoukro, an alternative host city, was also visited. The CAF delegation also held several meetings with various authorities and the country's Minister of Sports, Alain Lobogno, and inspected hotels, training grounds, stadiums, and medical centers. The CAF committee started its work in Guinea, which was inspected from April 7th to 12th. Over the coming months, the delegation will make similar visits to Algeria, Cameroon, Zambia, and the Democratic Republic of Congo in that order. After the inspection, the committee will present its report to CAF. The CAF Executive Committee meeting in September 2014 will then decide on the host nations for the 2019 and 2021 Africa Cup of Nations. Let's now go to our weekly tidbits on this year's World Cup in Brazil. It is now 53 days to the kickoff of the tournament, and the countdown continues. One of Africa's 5 representatives at the World Cup, Ivory Coast, was among several teams that saw their World Cup 2014 odds dwindle with injuries this week. Ivory Coast is the highest-ranked team in Africa in the FIFA World Rankings, and it is currently going off at plus 400 in current Group C betting odds. Ivory Coast could have to do without one of its best players, as Yaya Toure suffered a groin injury in English Premier League play this past week. The injury couldn't have come at a worse time for Toure, who is enjoying a career high with Manchester City this year. The star midfielder has 18 goals in 31 appearances for Man City in 2013-2014, matching his goal total from the previous 3 years combined. With the exception of Didier Drogba, no player means more to the Ivory Coast offense than Yaya Toure. Ivory Coast will try to advance out of Group C, facing Colombia, Japan, and Greece. And the FIFA World Cup trophy is in Los Angeles today, Sunday, as part of his tour of the United States ahead of the 2014 tournament in Brazil. The trophy is on the last leg of its 8-month-long pre-tournament tour, which has already seen it visit Africa, Asia, Europe and South America. At the end of his tour in Brazil, the famous Golden Prize would have visited 90 countries over 221 days and covered 92,000 miles around the world on a specially chartered plane. Last Monday, U.S. Vice President Joe Biden and U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry took their turn seeing the World Cup trophy at an event in Washington. They were also joined by U.S. soccer legends Kobe Jones and Julie Foudy. The trophy made stops in Miami and Atlanta before arriving in Los Angeles on Saturday. Meanwhile, it's been announced that Vice President Joe Biden will be leading the cheers for the U.S. team to bring home the coveted trophy for the first time. The White House announced that Biden will travel to Brazil in June to attend the World Cup. Back in Africa, none of the five teams that will fly the African flag in Brazil has taken up the offer by the continent soccer governing body, CAF, to have them train at its center of excellence in Cameroon. In February, CAF announced it will cover the cost of training at the CAF Center of Excellence in Mbankomo, Cameroon, for the African teams to the 2014 FIFA World Cup. CAF also called on the entire African continent to support the five teams: Algeria, Cameroon, Ghana, Ivory Coast, and Nigeria. Curiously, it seems none of the teams will even be training anywhere in Africa for the World Cup, which kicks off on June 12th and runs through July 13th. Meanwhile, while still battling with the preparations for the World Cup, Brazilian authorities have unveiled an infrastructure budget of $10.76 billion US dollars for the Rio 2016 Olympic Games. The budget is 25% more than planned as the country tries to reassure the world it can deliver facilities on time. The budget covers 27 projects in urban development and public transport. The Rio 2016 Organizing Committee estimated in 2009 that the games will cost 12.8 billion US dollars in total. With just over 2 years to go, the International Olympic Committee and World Sporting Federations last week criticized the Brazilian government for the slow pace of work, and some asked about contingency plans should Brazil fail to deliver. Brazil is racing to finish soccer stadiums in time for the World Cup, a prestigious event its leaders hoped will signify the South American nation's emergence as a world power, but now risks being an international embarrassment that could get worse if the Rio Olympics are similarly troubled. Finally, the 2014 Boston Marathon will hold on Monday. This will be the first running of the race since a pair of bombings ruined the 2013 edition. This year's event will see the second largest field of runners in race history. Some 36,000 runners have entered for the 2014 Boston Marathon. Only the 1996 edition has seen this many runners entered, with 38,708 entrants. About 4,600 of the over 5,000 runners who could not finish last year's race due to the bombings accepted entry into the 2014 race. Lelisa Desisa of Ethiopia and Rita Jeptu of Kenya won the men's and women's events at the 2013 Boston Marathon. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos. Now sending it back to Douglas the Mighty Mpuga in Washington.
Thank you, Segun. Segun on the dot, Adeyemi will be back again next Sunday for another look at African sports, that is Nightline Africa Sports. Yes, you're listening to Lane Africa. We're coming to you from Washington, and this is the time we get to listen to some music from the continent. Here we go.
I'm sorry, Lulingo Testinga. Naye Captain Chulida, Capoya Fe Machinga. Anyway, Wagaliza.
pagaliza pagaliza luna kolulu
luna kolulu
ayori nalinze
omulunji
nkulinzo mulunji baby pagaliza 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 luna kolulu
luna kolulu
Esenga kaya bigambo yendo wose sesanga
chengenda nange nakusa
tugende wena kutusa na wangomyewo bena tugende oba tusulamu kuba tusulemu kumo mukwano gwongwe sunga sifayo oba bucha ne bucha
perekera ko wono tusa chengenda nange nakusa njagala ntandikire mama ne tata we bakoma boba alowooza nti okuze nnyo sikulaba kukyalimu ekyejo kuba ndaba okyetaaga kulerebwa ng'omwana wetaaga kuwekebwa nga bebi okyetaaga ennywa nto ng'omwana nja kuyimbira ng'obuyimba bwe bayimbira abaana abato nga gwe tengerere omwana ayimiridde tulo tulo kwata omwana simbula tambula nali nepanka nnyo mutali mulenzi alimpangula naye omwana ono era mmadde n'ensonyi nnyingi ng'okunjogerako nti njagala gundi ng'ekyo kinkaabya naye omwana ono ne bwonjogerera kale nsanyuka busanyusa kusasulira ne rediyo mwogere mwogere mperekerako owa batusanga batusange nishauriawo owa batulopa batulope
bena tugende oba tusulemu kuba tusulemu kuma omukwano gwongwesunga sifayo oba bucya ne bucya
perekerako wono tusa jengenda nange nakusa
sente bwetutyo mugwanya wabwe sina bwendi
nebwanalamama kabe tatanga kuganye mwatukugwe kwensibidde
sente bwetutyo mugwanya wabwe sina bwendi
yes, how about that on Easter Sunday? That was our Sunday Music Sport. I sincerely hope you enjoyed the music from us here at Nightline Africa, coming into right from the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, and indeed in time of peace. One man's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Take it away, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. What has gone wrong with the leadership of South Sudan? In the long, protracted war with Sudan, they demonstrated exemplary unity despite the difficulties. There was much promise when they successfully negotiated in 2005 the Comprehensive Peace Accord that provided for the exercise of self-determination of the people of South Sudan. But after South Sudan seceded from the Sudan after the successful referendum and became Africa's newest state, reports began to circulate of ethnic rivalry and much corruption among the leadership. The continuation of rebel activities in both the Sudan and South Sudan did not help matters. At times, it appeared that full-scale war between both countries will break out. But both sides made special efforts to reconcile their differences. But ethnic rivalries persisted in South Sudan. And there was great surprise when President Kiir decided to disband his entire cabinet. That meant that Riek Machar, a well-known field commander during the Civil War and the vice president, was out in the cold. His many supporters claimed the ethnic factors were involved, and Riek Machar himself declared that he would contest the presidential election during the next election. A little later, there was a shocking announcement that there had been an attempted coup d'etat and Riek Machar was implicated by the government. Some commentators and experts suggested that there was no attempted coup and that the allegation was a pretext to damage the political prospects of the accused. In the circumstances, there was open split in the SPLM/SPLA when Riek Machar led a rebel movement against the government. This was embarrassing to the African continent. It gave support to the odious notion that Africans are incapable of governing themselves peacefully. Through concerted efforts, the African Union arranged for peace talks between the parties in Addis Ababa. Although the talks opened, they have stalled over the issue of representation on the rebel side. The government has refused to accept or recognize some of the participants on the side of the rebels. But what was most disconcerting is the impression that some in the leadership held the vain hope that the matter could be resolved on the battlefield. This is a mirage. The dispute could not be resolved on the battlefield. Attempts to wage war would be at the expense of the unfortunate civilians. Already, we have learned of mass killings of civilians, even when they have sought refuge in United Nations compounds. There have been a large outflow of refugees to neighboring countries. Continuing fighting has not helped the fragile economy of the state. The frequent capture and recapture of oil fields is only making matters worse. Today, Bentiu may be in the hands of the rebels, but what about tomorrow? It is time for the South Sudanese leadership to get serious. Africa and the international community have invested a great deal on the success of Africa's newest state. Instead of fighting to see which ethnic group or leader would prevail, serious efforts should be made to promote good governance, economic development, and the welfare of the suffering civilians of South Sudan. I thank you.
That was a one man's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us tonight. Hoping you enjoyed the program. And as you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Together with the rest of the Nightline team, I say thank you for listening and hope to see you again next Saturday. I'm Douglas Mpuga in Washington.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
As the United Nations prepares to send a peacekeeping force to end the intercommunal fighting that has torn apart the Central African Republic and created a humanitarian crisis there, the United States is stepping up its engagement to help restore peace and stability. On April 8th, a delegation of U.S. religious leaders representing several faiths traveled to the CAR to meet with their counterparts there and government officials. Led by the U.S. Special Envoy to the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, Rashad Hussein, the group stressed the solidarity between religious communities in our two countries. It also urged interfaith cooperation to promote dialogue on greater religious tolerance and national reconciliation. Sources of the conflict in the CAR are many, but much of the fighting has taken on a sectarian character as anti-Balaka militias began attacking Muslim civilians in retaliation for Seleka rebel abuses. The violence has caused tens of thousands to flee their homes in the capital, Bangui, and the western half of the country. The U.S. delegation visited a mosque and the cathedral in Bangui, met with representatives of international aid groups, members of civil society, officials of the government led by transitional President Catherine Samba Panza, as well as with representatives of the Seleka and Anti-Balaka. In a communique signed April 8th in Bangui, the parties renounced violence as a tool to resolve disputes and appealed to all citizens to disarm. They expressed appreciation for the role of the religious authorities at the national and local levels to try to pacify relations between religious communities and prevent violence. They further encouraged intercommunity and interreligious dialogues to mitigate tensions and lay the foundations for a new, peaceful coexistence. Lastly, they asked the transitional authorities to implement the Republic Covenant, signed by the transitional government on November 7, 2013, as a credible framework for promoting an inclusive national dialogue between all parties in the country. This should serve as a foundation for a new, peaceful coexistence. The United States is committed to promoting such dialogue as it continues other forms of assistance. We have pledged up to $100 million this year to support African Union troops and the French forces supporting them in their efforts to restore security to the people of CAR. In addition, we are providing $67 million this year to address the humanitarian needs of the CAR population.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.